Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, here with Sean Blackman, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. And today we are here talking a bit about climate change and what can actually be done about it. We are very happy to be joined here by Dr. David Schwartzman, who is a professor emeritus of Howard University and one half of the authorial duo, David Schwartzman and Peter Schwartzman, the Dr. Schwartzman, of the book, The Earth is Not for Sale, A Path Out of Fossil Capitalism to the Other World That Is Still Possible. Dr. Schwartzman, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. And let me just say that Peter has a connection with you, Eugene, that you know. He met you 20 years ago when you were 11 years old because he was a grad student at UVA Charlottesville, and he volunteered for Head Start.
Upward Bound.
Nope,
you're fine. He was one of the many intrepid volunteers who volunteered their time for reasons we don't know, to help the youth of the Central Virginia area succeed. But no, absolutely, there's still a few photos out there. I have my mom looking for them of myself and Peter Schwartzman, but she was pretty thrilled to hear that you all had the book out. So hopefully we'll be able to pass you some photos soon. You know, I wanted to just start here, David, almost a little bit with the title, because one thing that we've actually talked a lot about on this show as it concerns the issue of climate change is this sort of sense of, I think, despair that often sets in with people because the problem seems so huge. You know, how could it possibly actually be solved? But it seems that the real message, maybe underlying message of The Earth is Not for Sale, is that this is not a done deal, that it's not over. There is, in fact, actually things that can still be done to prevent the most catastrophic situation. So it's a hopeful book, perhaps over and above anything else.
Yes, that's a critical question. That's a critical point. Perhaps the title should have been rephrased. The Earth should not be for sale. It is very much for sale now. And perhaps it should have said a path out of fossil capitalism to the other world that is still barely possible. But I didn't want to be that pessimistic because I think it is we still have a huge opportunity not only to prevent catastrophic climate change, but to open up the end of the rule of capital on the planet, because the two are really connected, and that's where fossil capitalism comes in. We call it fossil capitalism. I guess it's like a double entendre, because it's fossil because it's most of the energy is derived from fossil fuel. And secondly, capitalism is now a zombie, walking on the planet and devouring both humans and nature. So it's a fossil system which is way beyond its time, and it needs to be replaced.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very relevant point, and I want to delve into some of what you all threw out here. And I've read the book. I really highly recommend it to really anyone who's interested in the issue, but a lot of just really, I think, interesting scientific information presented in a way that people can actually understand, which I think is important. You know, in the fourth chapter, you delve into the issue of the role of solar and what solar energy can possibly do, among other things, to help us broach or bridge the gap, as it were, and move forward from sort of this fossil fuel economy. And I wanted to start there because this is a question that I've seen, you know, in different places, green social thought and places like that, somewhat pushed back on this. And the idea being the technologies, whether they be solar, whether they be wind, whatever they are really actually not sufficient to address the energy needs of the world today. And we have to have some sort of bridge. Whether this is, I have not seen necessarily in green social thought, which has a different point of view, but I have seen this in mainstream things. Groups like Greenpeace, for instance, have said this. We need a bridge. Some cases, some people say nuclear. Obviously, that's a big issue in France and other countries. Some say natural gas, which is obviously a smaller subset of people. But just this idea, I wonder how you address that the technology isn't really ready, and that given the time scale, we're going to have to use something, be it nuclear or whatever, to bridge the gap while we develop new sort of energy technologies at scale.
Well, I don't agree that the technology is not ready, but we do need a bridge. So the two, actually, I agree with. We need a bridge because we need to create a solar infrastructure globally, And it has to be powered by the existing energy infrastructure, which is mainly fossil fuel. And I'll get into this a little bit more about which fossil fuel should be used and which should be phased out first. But my oldest son, Peter, and I did mathematical modeling and published it in 2011 and really showed using the best measure of the solar, wind and solar technology capacity to actually expand and replace fossil fuel and nuclear power is the energy return over an energy invested ratio. And it was sufficient even then to make the transition, a full transition in a few decades, and actually supplying more energy to the world than is currently supplied. And I can also amplify on that. Mm-hmm. But let me just get back to the point, which is the fossil fuel of choice. The fossil fuels with the biggest greenhouse gas footprint are coal, natural gas, and it's not you just burn natural gas. It has half the carbon emission per energy created as coal, but because methane leaks directly to the atmosphere and it's pretty much unavoidable, it's actually even worse than coal. Certainly frack gas is, and even conventional. And so actually the fossil fuel of choice to make the bridge is actually conventional oil. And to do away with itself and use the minimum necessary to replace it.
Mm.
And this is a critical point because we want to limit as much as possible the greenhouse gas emissions in the replacement process. And what's also important about conventional oil is that various oil producers in the world, like Venezuela, like the Middle East, have potentially a very important role to play in this transition. And of course, the current regime change agenda of our imperialist administration is blocking that from happening, not only because Trump, withdrew from the Paris agreements, but because it's blocking the kind of cooperative regime we need globally to make this transition.
And Dr. Schwartzman, when you were talking a little earlier about fossil capitalism, I was thinking some about that and about how when we see these sort of reactionary resistance to sort of a real dialogue about climate change, and we see this sort of outright denial about climate change that really isn't based on anything, what role does sort of, capital play in that and corporate interest play in that? Because it seems that if if the eco-socialism that you're proposing, you and Peter and the Earth Is Not For Sale, was to be put in place, then there's some folks who are going to lose a whole lot of money.
Oh, yes. And actually, your question brings up a very important division within capital, and that's between militarized fossil capital and so-called green capital. And let me stress that we do not argue that green capital will give us salvation and that we should just use the market mechanism and trust it to deliver. And there are some that believe this. But we don't, and we need to, our strategy, which we support, which actually was really in the national dialogue discourse, was introduced by the Green Party, and that is of a Green New Deal with demilitarization and the end of the imperial policies. And, of course, we should recognize a very important initiative that Ocasio-Cortez and so on has introduced in Congress. That's a very important beginning. But it's the divisions between green capital and militarized fossil capital that I think the movement needs to fully utilize in politically to generate a strong enough movement to actually pull the legs under demilitarized fossil capital and make possible not only prevention of catastrophic climate change, but a more favorable terrain for class struggle to end the rule of capital, period. because we can't simply rely on green capital in many respects. First of all, their interests are profit too. And so we need it to, in this climate energy justice movement, to have struggles around the actual process of replacement. And we go into this. You know, building solar, building wind potentially has negative impacts on both humans and the environment, and those have to be reduced as much as possible by what we call multidimensional transnational class struggle.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me also ask you this on that note, because I think certainly we are seeing more and more sort of green capital emerge as a player in the political landscape. Yeah. That's certainly for sure. And I think you can even look at the politics of, say, a state like Iowa, which is sort of a red state where, you know, many of these interests have become very interesting. I guess here's a twofold question. You know, my one-fold question, my first part of the question is this, and that is, you know, what is sort of the agency process here? Because certainly green capital is looking to a certain subset of the Democratic Party, but I think we certainly know that the leadership of the Democratic Party will do whatever it can, even to the extent it's willing to address climate change, to pull it into cap and trade and the like. I mean, I think certainly this is what Jay Inslee, if he runs for president, will run on in 2020, this, like, you know, very green capitalist program of change. So, you know, what about the role of the Democrats in the blockage? And sort of my secondary and related question then is, what is the process by which we can prevent sort of a almost maybe, let's say, a reconstruction scenario, right? Like, it's similar to the Civil War, where an element of capital allied with the popular forces to defeat the slaveocracy, and then they move the popular forces to the side and establish their own rule. You know, what do we do that we, okay, great. It certainly would be an advance for humanity to, like, get in front of climate change, no doubt about that. But then once we maybe start to get there, how do we prevent the sort of green capital from then saying, okay, well, this is as far as we're going to go, and we're not really going to address poverty, income inequality, and so on and so forth, and perhaps even imposing a lower standard of living on working class people as, in and of itself, its own form of quote-unquote climate policy?
Yes, you kind of outlining a scenario which I think is very unlikely, but it's all contingent to the strength of popular movements of the climate energy justice movement, not only nationally, but internationally. So to the first part deals with the Democratic Party. I'm a member of the Green Party. I've worked outside and as an eco-socialist, and I respect the efforts of people trying to, let's say, change the agenda of the Democratic Party. You know, the Bernie supporters, Our Revolution, and so on, and DSA, by the way, which Democratic Social America, which I joined after the 2016 election because I always thought they were too moderate, but I'm not that disappointed. I'm not disappointed, let's say now. And I think it's not only DSA, but other socialist groups, certainly PSL, and many other socialist organizations have a very important role to play, both really in building a movement outside the electoral arena that is necessary actually to have an impact on the electoral state. So, again, first of all, it's the working class in its broadest sense, including the working class that will be enlarged if with the Green New Deal, that it certainly should be unionized and better organized. And this is not only nationally, but transnationally. Right. This is the force that has to be built to be powerful enough to be what we call a global subject.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me also ask you this, because I think this is very relevant to the point you made, and certainly you are a member of the Green Party, certainly well-known member of the Green Party here in the D.C. area. But I'm curious your thoughts about the role of the Green Party now, seeing people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez bring up the Green New Deal that, as you correctly mentioned, several Green Party candidates in a row had raised. And a lot of these issues that youth activists are raising are very much things that were at the margins but being sort of pushed consistently by Green candidates all around the country. I mean, is the Green Party, in your view, a vehicle for a lot of this energy, especially given that, you know, in some places— there are breakthroughs like the Ocasio-Cortezes of the world, but in many places still, it's not that easy to really get on if you're pushing an aggressive climate policy, even in Democratic primaries. You know, people want to shut you down. Yes. And so what is your message, I think, at a time that I think some people are trying to suggest, well, maybe the Green Party is a little obsolete. As a Green, what is your message to young folks who are looking to make change on this, who are pushing a lot of these ideas that have conditionally have traditionally been sort of Green Party ideas?
Well, I could, to use a term that's overused, I think we're at a political tipping point, both because of the shift in views about the reality of climate change, which recently they had a survey, you know, these extreme weather events are having an impact. And even people that were deniers are now changing their views. And that's certainly a majority, a growing majority of the American people, and certainly people of the world, especially in the global south, appreciate and fully recognize the threat of climate change. So it's going to be certainly a challenge for Green Party candidates to put forward the most, let's say, progressive and plausible program to confront this challenge,
right,
which is really threatening civilization. It's threatening biodiversity as we know it. And so this is the challenge we face. It's not, you know, I'm an optimist, but I'm looking forward at, for instance, in D.C.,
yeah,
for in 2020, we will very likely have matching funds from the city because of D.C. Fair Elections law. And I'm looking forward to some candidates going forward, maybe even someone in this room, and actually being elected. And I think this is going to happen around the country. Of course, I'm disappointed that the Green Party hasn't elected anyone to Congress yet. But I think it's happening. It's not only the Green Party. It will be other independent socialist forces.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope there will be a convergence in the future, sooner than later, of these, let's say, socialist, eco-socialist, progressive forces politically to magnify their political power.
Well, you know, one thing, since you mentioned D.C., and I don't want to bury the lead here, we got about 3 minutes left.
Yes.
You are going to be speaking on the book here in D.C., I believe this Sunday. Am I correct?
Yes, indeed. It's thanks for mentioning that. It's at Busboys and Poets, 14th and V Street at 6 p.m., 6 to 8 p.m. I'm looking forward to eating one of their Mediterranean pizzas. Not while I'm talking, though. So come on this Sunday, 6 p.m., Busboys at 14th and V. And
yeah,
thank you for mentioning that.
No, of course. Happy to mention it. I think it's going to be a very interesting conversation. I mean, I want to just plug the book again. The Earth is Not for Sale, A Path Out of Fossil Capitalism to the Other World That's Still Possible. Peter Schwartzman and David Schwartzman. Really great book. A lot of content in there. And I definitely think if you're in the D.C. area, 6 p.m. on Sunday, definitely check out David at Busboys and Poets. Plenty to talk about, and I'm sure there will be plenty of time. We're going to have to leave it there for now. Dr. David Schwartzman,